On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Donald Trump is probably the most significant thing to happen to the religious right in a few decades.
OMG, this guy is actually a bigot.
If she becomes president, no one since Richard Nixon would have been on the national stage that long and won the White House.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
Lived in Malibu for over 10 years. And our two children, Presley and Kaya, are both students at Malibu High School. I'm not a scientist, and before last fall, I had never even heard of PCBs. Federal law calls for the removal of any PFOS with PCBs over 50 parts per million. We know that we have PFOS containing more than that, yet somehow the school district and the EPA have decided that the best course of action for our school and for our children is to manage it in place.
Supermodel Cindy Crawford calling for the Santa Monica Malibu Unified School District to remove PCBs from Malibu schools. The use of PCBs in building materials was banned in 1979, but structures, including schools built before then, still contain them. How big a problem is that? We'll have that story coming up. But first, the Supreme Court has soundly rejected a new way of drawing voting districts. The justices rejected the attempt to create districts based on eligible voters and left in place the status quo, districts apportioned by the number of people living in them. In a rare unanimous decision, the court said that the change would be a threat to the American idea of one person, one vote. Jessica Levinson is a professor at Loyola Law School who specializes in election law, and she's here now to give us the details. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. So a rare majority decision. What did the justices say?
A rare unanimous decision, as you said.
Unanimous, yeah.
And so it was, again, the Justice Notorious RBG, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who wrote for the majority. And there were two justices concurring, Justice Alito and Justice Thomas on the conservative side. And essentially what she said is, Texas, you are not required to draw district lines according to voting age population. You can continue, like all of the other 49 states, to draw district lines according to the total population. So that, you know, that sounds a little kind of semantic. What difference does it make? If the plaintiffs had won and the new rule had been, in according to the Constitution, that you have to draw district lines according to voting age population, it would significantly change political power in America. So what it would do is it would shift power to much more rural districts. It would shift power, frankly, to conservative, older, whiter districts. And so this is a legal case, but it's very much about politics. It's very much about the challenge would have been a if it were successful, which it wasn't, a huge boon to Republicans.
Right. And understood in all of this was the issue of undocumented immigrants.
Well, that's right. So if we're talking about who is represented in a district, are we talking about only people who can vote, or are we talking about everybody who lives there? So the big difference in terms of total population versus voting population is children, undocumented immigrants, and felons. And frankly, undocumented immigrants is really what we're talking about when we're talking about political power, I think. So if this had gone the other way, there were estimates that something like 55% of Latinos, including children and undocumented immigrants, I think it was 45% of African Americans, 35% of Asians, numbers kind of around there, would not have been represented because those groups were not voting eligible.
And is it significant that this case was brought from Texas by a group, I believe they're called the Project on Fair Representation?
Yes. So this is a group, I would say, you know, they were rooting for unfair representation. And I think that's what Justice Ginsburg also agreed. But this is a group that's waged a lot of conservative challenges. So they're also trying to undo affirmative action laws and say that those are not appropriate. They have been behind.
Also a Texas case.
There, a lot of affirmative action and voting rights cases tend to come out of Texas. It's the, you know, hotbed of if you're teaching voting rights, there's a lot of different Texas is kind of a microcosm of everything mm-hmm. that's happening. And Texas was, as we said, a good place for the challenge because there is such a big percentage of undocumented Latinos in those districts that we were thinking about how to draw.
Okay, so as you say, Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote the opinion for the unanimous opinion. She also said, we need not and do not resolve whether states may draw districts to equalize voter eligible population rather than total population, as you indicated earlier. Does that give them a loophole, the states?
It could mean that Texas then would try to, or another state would try and draw lines according to the voting population to make all districts equal according to eligible voters. I think that there's two big reasons why a state might not want to do that. First is that the Supreme Court has absolutely not blessed it. It's just said we're not passing on that, which is probably how you got an 8-0 decision. Mm-hmm. And so any state that does that is going to face significant legal challenges. And the second is it's actually hard to draw those district lines and not potentially fly in the face of the Voting Rights Act, which requires a protection of minority voters in certain circumstances. So the court didn't give the, you know, go ahead and say it's fine to do either. The court just said you don't have to draw the lines according to voting age population. So you can do, like every other state does, total population, and that's it, period, end of day. And, you know, you kind of see Ruth Bader Ginsburg sailing out in one of her RBG T-shirts, like, drops mic, I'm done.
But in practical terms, the House of Representatives is Republican controlled. It's pretty conservative now. It's been leaning more conservative in recent elections. And a lot of people say, well, that's because of gerrymandering, that these districts are already drawn so heavily to ensure a dominance of the Republican Party, that what effect would this have anyway?
Well, so the case was about state legislative district lines. And, you know, your question was exactly right, but about congressional mm-hmm. district lines. And what's interesting in the opinion, actually, is that she kind of reasons by analogy from the Constitution and how we used to draw, or how we decided to draw, congressional district lines, and says, well, the same is true for the states. But, you know, yes, absolutely, our districts on the federal and state level tend to be heavily gerrymandered. Maybe one exception is actually California, where we have an independent redistricting commission. We take the power to draw these district lines out of the hands of the legislatures who have a conflict of interest. You know, it's like me setting my salary at Loyola. Like, well, I think I did a great job. Thank you. I'll draw all my, you know, donors and the heavy voting population. So the practical effect, you know, really, I think, would have been much more power for Republicans. Yes, they have done a good job of gerrymandering, but this would have given even more of a boost. And, you know, in terms of how much would it have affected, we don't actually know, because I think one of the big issues with this case is there wasn't the good data to draw the lines according to voting age population. So those numbers just weren't even there. So practically speaking, it would have just been, you know, beyond an enormous headache to try and comply with a Supreme Court ruling that went the other way. We have the total population numbers. We really don't have the voting eligible numbers the way we should.
Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School, thank you.
Thank you.
Parents of students in Malibu are suing the Santa Monica Malibu Unified School District, saying that schools like Malibu High are too dangerous for their kids. The culprit? PCBs, a substance that was widely used in construction materials before 1980. PCBs are now banned. Well, two Malibu schools have elevated levels of PCBs in window caulking. The school district and the EPA have said the schools are safe. But parents and some experts disagree. And joining us now to talk about PCBs, where they are, and how often we come into contact with them is Robert Herrick, senior lecturer at the Harvard School of Public Health. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Okay, so first, from what you understand about this case, do Malibu parents have reason to be concerned about their schools?
I think the concerns are well-founded. The data that's been collected so far shows extraordinarily high levels of PCBs in the building caulking. And I think what's a source of great concern is that the school district is reluctant and actually refuses to continue to do that testing.
So the district hired an environmental consulting firm, and one of the spokespeople said that just because something is present doesn't mean it can cause harm. Tell us from your research, what is the threshold where PCBs are a health hazard?
Well, EPA established levels that they consider to be acceptable in schools, although it's worth noting that even in EPA's own document, they issued caveats and warnings that people shouldn't interpret these numbers as being some kind of bright line between safe and unsafe conditions. But in the case of the Malibu schools, some of the air testing that was done showed levels that approached the EPA guidelines, and in all cases were greatly elevated over the levels of PCBs you would find in outdoor air.
And I understand that the levels were actually changed recently by EPA, that they actually increased the levels the chemicals are deemed safe or unsafe?
Well, they did. They made some adjustments because the standard they had before is adjusted based on the age of the children. And so they made some small changes in the allowable levels for the youngest children. But they weren't, very substantial changes, but it is correct that they up them a little bit.
So what is holding back the school from just making these adjustments? I mean, if this is causing a big uproar and there have been testing that shows the presence of PCB, why not just make the changes? Is it cost prohibitive? Is that usually the problem for when schools in other places balk at remediation?
Well, it is costly. There's no doubt about it. But I think the great concern that the parents are expressing is that they've seen what happens in other parts of the country, particularly here in New England and in New York. The EPA regions have worked with the schools and other buildings, too, because this isn't unique to schools. And they've worked together and come up with remediation plans where they've removed the source of the PCBs, which is the caulking material, and replaced it with safe substitutes and sealed off the source. Now, this isn't a cheap fix. It can cost $1 million to do this kind of renovation in a school. But based on what I've seen from the Malibu case, the school district has already spent many times that amount, $5 or $6 million, on consultants and lawyers to try to fight this.
How widespread is this in schools across the country?
Well, we've done some calculations. There's pretty good data about the number of schools that were built during the period of about 1950 to 1980. That was, coincided with the time the baby boomers all started showing up at the schoolhouse door. And so there was a huge surge in construction in that time period. And that coincides with the period when PCBs were very commonly used. So the data that we have suggests that there could easily be as many as 25,000 schools in the country that have PCBs in the caulking.
And when you consider all the, health problems, the environmental problems that we have, from lead to polluted air to polluted water, et cetera, where does this rank?
Well, I think given what we're learning about the developmental toxicity of PCBs, I would rank this pretty high. It's really the same concern that we have about lead, is that the level that poses a risk to children is much, much lower than it is to adults. And I think that's the case with PCBs as well. The evidence is rapidly accumulating that they're very potent developmental toxins.
So what are the effects?
Well, the studies that have been done show that, for example, you have impairments in the development of cognitive function, and that shows itself in lower levels of IQ, for example. There's evidence that it affects the growth rate in children, and there's a lot of information coming in, both from human and animal studies, that suggests that the PCBs are endocrine disruptors and have a variety of effects.
And in terms of how stringent the EPA standards are and the remediation efforts on the part of the EPA, is it different in different parts of the country?
Well, yes, it is. And that's the part I personally find most perplexing, is that there's really no coherent national policy that would keep one EPA regional office from behaving very differently from the other. And the contrast, as I mentioned, between, say, Region 1 here in Boston and what we see Region 9 doing, I find just appalling.
And where in Region 9? It's here in the West Coast?
That's the area that the Malibu school was under, yes.
And so you're saying that the Region 9 area is more lax when it comes to regulating these chemicals?
Well, they definitely are. For example, they have allowed the school to stop testing the caulk, even though they had high levels found in several of the rooms. They have allowed the schools to not test adjoining rooms or rooms directly across the hallway from the area where the high PCB levels were found, which is just preposterous because the school was all built, you know, with the same contractors and the same construction materials. There's no reason to think that a room across the hall from a room that has high PCBs would be any different.
Robert Herrick at the Harvard School of Public Health, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Well, we'd love to hear from you. Are you worried about PCBs in your neighborhood, in your children's school? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can weigh in on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, forget broadcast, cable, Netflix. The kids are getting their TV somewhere else. We'll talk about that next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Santa Monica-based public radio station KCRW relies on the support of its listeners. One way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country. Put your old ride to good use and take advantage of a great tax write-off. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Every Monday, we do a TV roundup, what's worth talking about on TV. But frankly, it's a little like cleaning out the Aegean stables. There is so much content. Well, today we're just going to dive right into the muck, right into the stables, and talk about what's online. Natalie Jarvie is here. She's a digital reporter for The Hollywood Reporter. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, great to have you. There's so many ways to watch TV now, of course. There's the traditional way. Does anyone still do that? Yeah, probably. A lot of people still do.
I do.
You do. We all do. But it seems like more and more young people are going online and watching stuff online. So what is it that they're watching? How are they watching it? That's not just YouTube videos.
Yeah, there's so much out there right now. I mean, YouTube is probably still the kind of largest and most obvious place to go for, you know, makeup tutorials or to watch gamers play video games and figure out how to beat certain levels. There's also original content. There's actually scripted series that are coming to YouTube. But now there's also Vimeo for short form video. There's Snapchat. There's Vine for 6-second videos. I mean, it's just all over the web now.
Okay, so let's talk about YouTube. We will talk about YouTube now because they have this thing called YouTube Red, which is a subscription-only service.
Yeah, it launched last fall, and in February this year, they came out with their first slate of original programs. So these are shows that you can only find on YouTube Red. It's about $10 a month to subscribe. And, you know, they started out with, they have some documentaries. They have some movies. There's one called Dance Camp that's kind of like step up for today's teens and tweens. And then they have a couple original series as well. One that just launched last week is called Foursome. It's interesting because it's a little bit more mature than what we've seen or what you would think that a bunch of teens and tweens would be watching. It's about a young girl kind of exploring her sexuality in high school.
Okay, I think we have a clip of tape. This is from the opening credits of Foursome.
High school's like a good selfie. Sure, you can do it on your own, but if you really want to crush it, you have to surround yourself with your best friends. These are mine. Imogen. We're next door neighbors, and this is her first year of public school. She's adjusting. Courtney, my brother's girlfriend. She shouldn't even be here. She graduated last year, but can't seem to stay away. Dakota. His advice is top-notch, and he's the gayest straight shooter at Breyer. And Andy. Me. Just trying to land a boyfriend. Before I graduate. This is my foursome. The non-sexual kind.
So I can see why that's appealing to the youngs.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's got a young cast. It's a bunch of YouTube and Vine stars that they probably already know and love, but doing something a little bit different, playing a character as opposed to just being themselves on camera.
That's interesting. So they meshed YouTube and Vine to create this.
They did. There's a Vine star, Logan Paul, plays the older brother. He's really kind of exploded in the last year. He's doing a number of acting projects. And then Jen McAllister plays the sister. And then there's some more traditional stars mixed in there, too. So they've kind of blended all these different worlds to create this one show.
And this you have to subscribe to YouTube Red to get?
You do, yeah. And they're kind of following the Netflix format where mm-hmm. if you subscribe, you get all the episodes all at once, and they're going to kind of roll out new shows as the year goes on.
Are there any shows on YouTube or anywhere else? Vine, I don't know. You mentioned Vimeo is also mm-hmm. doing original programming. Anything for people a little bit older?
There are. I think Vimeo is probably the place that's kind of trying to make a name for itself in short form web content that's not necessarily just geared toward the teens and tweens. Their most popular show up until this point is called High Maintenance, and it was a couple creators, Katya Blitchfield and Ben Sinclair. They started it a couple years ago, and Vimeo found it and realized people were really engaging with it, and they actually came in and funded the most recent season, and now it's actually going to make the jump to HBO in sometime later this year.
So is that a proving ground then, Vimeo? And then the idea is to go to another sort of more traditional outlet like an HBO?
I think that the online platforms would not say that. They probably want these creators to stay there. But it's certainly a kind of a sign of validation that a major cable network like HBO saw potential in a show that came from Vimeo. And we're starting to see that more and more with, you know, Broad City on Comedy Central started out as a web series and then was developed into a TV show. So we're starting to see that transition happen occasionally.
Okay, so what are you seeing now that you think we should be watching?
Vimeo has a couple interesting shows that they just funded. There's a short series called, or a short film called Darby Forever that stars Adi Bryant, who you might know from Saturday Night uh-huh. Live. She's really fun, and it's a great little side project for her, and it's a great example of these online platforms giving people an outlet to make shows that probably wouldn't get picked up on a traditional TV network. Snapchat has started to do some interesting things. If we're going to talk more short form content, there's a whole area on Snapchat. It's a little hard to find, but it's called Discover, and that's where big brands like Cosmopolitan and ESPN and BuzzFeed all have little channels, and within each of those channels, they have all sorts of original shows that they're creating. Comedy Central, in fact, just renewed a bunch of different little short comedic shows.
And do those shows stick around or they go away?
So they're there for 24 hours and then they're gone. So you have to watch. You know, it kind of brings back the return of appointment viewing a little bit that we've lost in this age of streaming.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. So meanwhile, though, are young people interested in watching long form anymore? Or are they so used to Snapchat, here today, gone tomorrow, Vines, here 6 seconds, gone in 6 seconds?
You know, the great myth is that these young people aren't watching TV. They are. They're just watching it in a different way. Almost all of them, their parents have a Netflix subscription or a Hulu subscription. So they're going on to Netflix and they're watching every single episode of Friends from start to finish, and they're discovering Gilmore Girls for the first time. So they're definitely watching that longer form content, but, you know, they're much more used to getting what they want when they want it. And then they've got their phones in their pockets all day long. So that's when they're watching the YouTube videos and the Snapchats and the Vines. That's great for when you're waiting, you know, waiting for the bus in the morning, or you've got 5 minutes between activities.
And also creating their own stories with Snapchat.
Oh, yeah. The boundary between being a creator and a consumer is totally gone. So young people will see their favorite YouTube stars doing makeup tutorials and they say, hey, I can do that. That kid's there in their bedroom making videos. I can do that, too. And definitely with Snapchat, you know, they're constantly sending snaps to their friends or posting Vines. It changes the relationship that they have with the people that they're watching.
How do you keep up with this?
It's hard. I have to talk to young people. I mean, I'm constantly, when I meet someone who's between, you know, 12 and 18, asking, all right, what's the app that you're really into right now? What's the video that you watch? We just, at The Hollywood Reporter, had a group of young girls from a local middle school come in, and we sat them down in a conference room and asked them about all their favorite YouTube stars and who was cool and what videos they were watching. And it was fascinating, even for someone like me who's not that far out of that age range, how quickly it changes and how different a popular star can be, you know, just within a matter of a couple weeks.
So the answer is go find yourself a middle schooler to keep up to date. Right?
Absolutely.
Otherwise, you're going to be hopelessly behind. Natalie Jarvie covers digital media for The Hollywood Reporter. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, youngins, middle schoolers, what are your favorite YouTube, Snapchat, Vimeo shows, Vine stars? Tweet us at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, Robert Mapplethorpe was more than a photographer of erotica.
I mean, the culture war was all about saying these images are pornographic, that they're not fit material for art.
How the bad boy of photography helped turn photography into a respected art form. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Listen to KCRW's music stream, Eclectic 24, for hand-picked music around the clock. And you can find all of KCRW's produced content on our app. Download for free at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Although he was infamous for his more provocative photographs, Robert Mapplethorpe's work was actually diverse. The scope of that diversity is on display in two shows now running at LACMA and the Getty. He's also the subject of a new documentary that will premiere on HBO tonight. It's called Mapplethorpe, Look at the Pictures. Certainly, Mapplethorpe is best known for his black and white photos depicting the naked male body, sometimes in extreme sexual situations. Mapplethorpe was gay, and he explored his life and his sexuality in his art. Ironically, his most scandalous photos helped turn photography into a respected and mainstream art form. That contradiction is one of the ideas in the new documentary. At the Sundance Film Festival earlier this year, I sat down with the filmmakers, Fenton Bailey and Randy Barbato, along with Mapplethorpe's younger brother, Edward, who features prominently in the movie. We spoke at KCRW's makeshift studio at Sundance, a converted restaurant, and a warning that although there's no profanity, we talk about some pretty adult things. So the movie's title, Look at the Pictures. Now, that's a line from North Carolina, the former North Carolina Senator Jesse Helms, and he made this speech. He was fulminating on the Senate floor back in, 1989, was it, when he made that speech?
Robert Mapplethorpe, a known homosexual who died of AIDS and who spent the last years of his life promoting homosexuality.
And he's got a bunch of Robert Mapplethorpe's pictures, and he's talking to his fellow senators, and he's saying, look at the pictures.
Look at the pictures.
This was a quarter century ago. Just take us back to that time and tell us why those pictures were so central in the culture wars of the 1980s.
Well, you're so right. I think it's so hard for us to today imagine what it was like then, because this was pre-Google. So today, you can see any of those images in the Mapplethorpe's work online. But back then, I suppose, they were only seen as, I mean, the culture war was all about saying these images are pornographic, that they're not fit material for art.
Why was there such a struggle over the definition of art and what constituted art versus pornography?
Well, I don't think this was really about art at all. It was about politics. And what Jesse Helms was doing, he was an opportunist. He was taking some photographs completely out of context and using them as a sort of political weapon. And in the process, hijacking Mapplethorpe's name, Mapplethorpe's work. And actually, it was such a long time ago, and it seems so foreign and far away. And yet, given our current political climate, it also seems timely. It seems like even though these images might not be as shocking, politicians using art to further their careers, you can imagine it happening tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so let's go back in time. He grew up on Long Island.
Queens. Floral Park, Queens, which is a little suburban town just on the city line of Long Island. Very middle class. I always say it's like Archie Bunker. All the houses are sort of very similar or identical to each other.
Yeah. What was he like for you growing up? What do you remember of him? I know 13 years is a big
13 years is a big year, age difference. And he left home when he was 16, so I was only 3 years of age. And I don't have too many early memories until I would say I was maybe 9, 10, 11 years old when he would come into this back home with Patty.
Patty Smith.
And as you can imagine, what an impact that must have made on me. I mean, they didn't dress like anybody else. They didn't look like anybody else. They didn't speak like anybody else. And powerful energy around the two of them.
There's tape in the movie of your father
saying
that he would not have approved had he known that Robert was gay. He must have known, though.
He says that he always had his suspicions. He does say in the film that he never really talked to my mother about it and that my mother wouldn't have accepted that, which always surprised me. I mean, unfortunately, my mother died shortly after Robert, and I wish I had had more time to discuss all of this with her and him, but that's just the way the family was. We didn't talk about a lot of issues like that.
Well, when you heard your father's voice saying that, how did that make you feel?
Oh, I'm somewhat ashamed in some respect, but I admire my father in a lot of respects. I mean, there's certainly different people, but they have much more in common than you and the general public would understand. I mean, my father was an engineer, but he was a very creative engineer, and he had learned photography at a young age himself and processed film, had a darkroom, and that was how my interest sort of got catapulted. But, just very closed-minded, that's all I can say.
It's really interesting that he had the means to experiment with photography, Robert Mapplethorpe, when he was a child and young, and yet didn't show any interest, according to your movie.
Well, no, not according to our movie. According to Robert himself, he said he never wanted to be a photographer. And I think it's interesting that, you know, one of the things he said that always obsessed us, I suppose, was he said, you know, the life he was leading is more important than the pictures he was taking. And I think perhaps for him, photography became a way of documenting the work of art that was his life.
And the life he was leading was a very sexual life, a life of sexual experimentation and adventure.
Yes. I think the extraordinary thing was how honest and open he was all along. He never hid what he was doing or who he was. And this was at a time when being gay in the art world wasn't very accepted. Of course, there were a lot of gay people in the art world, but a lot of them were in the closet. And being out and open and documenting that life in your work was unheard of.
And also it was a time when photography wasn't considered a viable art form, too.
Yeah,
correct?
I mean, it's hard to believe, but 25, 30 years ago, many people wouldn't even fathom the notion that photography would be considered a fine art. And actually, Robert Mapplethorpe had an enormous impact on the evolution of photography now. I mean, now his collection lives at the Getty and the LACMA.
Take us back to when he started taking those photos, and, you know, for people who haven't seen them, I'm not going to really describe them on the radio,
yes,
but they're shocking now, but I can't imagine what their reception was back then.
Yeah, I mean, he would never show the explicit photography with any of his other photography. I mean, his body of work is broad, and it exists well beyond the explicit photography. But he knew that to share those photos, he either had to do it in a private place or he had to do it separate from any of his other work because it was so unusual to see such explicit imagery. By the way, beautifully shot, beautifully composed art. It was art, but the subject matter, I think, was so unusual for people.
I wonder if you could talk about the photograph that is such an iconic self-portrait that he took near the end of his life. And I believe you helped him set it up.
Well, I think I was instrumental in making that happen, in that he was given this beautiful cane with a skull carved into it by a friend of his, and he saw the beauty in the object, and he certainly wanted to photograph it, which we did on its own. And he had this idea of his hand holding it, and he was quite ill at that point. And, you know, this is the 23rd Street studio, and he was back in his bedroom, probably lying down, not feeling well, and I held it in my hand, and I held it out in front of me. And the Polaroid was powerful, and I brought it to Robert. I said, Robert, this is difficult to look at, but this is something that you really need to consider doing this. And he's like, wow. And I said, let's put on a black turtleneck, and let's get you in the studio. Let's make this happen. It's a picture of a man confronting his mortality and his death, and I'm quite proud and humbled by the fact that he had the wherewithal and the strength to do that.
Right before he dies, I mean, he's diagnosed, and very quickly he progresses very quickly, the disease. I think it's, 2 years or so, mm-hmm. and he's dead. And those last years are a frenzy of activity, and he wants to make a lot of money and, make his reputation. And did he succeed in doing that in that time? And I also wonder, with the whole controversy, you know, going back to the Jesse Helms fight over this as pornography, did that in some strange way elevate him and elevate his stature as an artist?
Oh, absolutely. His art gallery dealer says, from the moment he was diagnosed, he was determined to work like crazy, and he wasn't concerned about his health. He never talked about his health. It was like, talk about the sales. And I think he had turned his life into a work of art, his death was not going to be excluded from that. And he was determined to make his death part of that work of art. And he just worked flat out. I think even the final exhibition, The Perfect Moment, he knew he was dying. He knew this was it. And so, yes, while Jesse Helms hijacked his vision, I think Mapplethorpe was one step ahead of him. And he knew that the controversy would elevate his status and stature as an artist, nationally and internationally. And you know what? It did.
And now his photographs are worth...
Man in the Polyester Suit just sold for half a million dollars.
Million dollars. Wow.
And this is a picture of
This is a picture of a man in a polyester suit with his zipper open and a
phallus.
Big black
enormous
penis coming out of the zipper.
It's a fantastic, it's picture.
Funny.
It's exactly.
It's funny picture.
He was a serious artist, and that doesn't exclude the fact that he also had a great sense of humor and that there is playfulness in the work as well.
I want to ask you about the curators. You have scenes of curators going through his pictures for an upcoming exhibition, and they treat the photograph so reverentially. And meanwhile, you cut back to Robert Mapplethorpe and kind of him just taking Polaroids and it being such a more rough and ready kind of situation. And I just wonder if you could talk about the contrast there.
The irony is there's something sort of almost fetishistic about the way the curators are handling this material. So it's just ironic. And when they are looking at some of the imagery, there's a very famous self-portrait of Robert with a whip in a position I can't describe, when they're talking about the contrast of the paper, by the way, it helps this film because it puts these images in a context that reminds you, okay, it's okay to look at the pictures and look at them as art. And it's also kind of funny.
It's really funny. Fenton Bailey and Randy Barbato are the directors of Mapplethorpe, Look at the Pictures, which premieres on HBO tonight. Edward Mapplethorpe is Robert's younger brother. He's one of the subjects of the film and an artist in his own right. Robert Mapplethorpe, The Perfect Medium, is on display at both the Getty and LACMA museums through July 31st. Coming up, how one apartment building manager in Hollywood played a leading role in the gay rights movement. That story is next on Press Play.
Check out KCRW's All News channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more. 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Now let's take a trip to Hollywood, to one 90-year-old apartment building. It's been home to movie stars, to rock stars, and to one little-known civil rights pioneer. His name is Tony Sullivan, and his personal history is closely tied to the building he's lived and worked in for more than 30 years. Press Play producer Anna Scott has this story in our series, L.A. Dwellings.
Hi. Good to see you again.
Tony Sullivan keeps a framed newspaper ad from 1925 on the wall outside his apartment.
Electric washing machines, that was a big deal in those days.
It's for the grand opening of the building we're standing in, the Afton Arms, also sometimes nicknamed Happy Malaga Castle. The ad, in its old-timey way, makes it clear this is a classy place.
The Afton Arms emphasizes its appeal to married couples, all caps, and then again in all caps, it is not a transient apartment house.
Tony's managed this building since 1986. He's turned it from a virtual crack den to a quiet, charming place.
The fountain's dirty at the moment because it's got to be...
Tony has a lot of memories here. Inside his ground floor apartment, he keeps another framed image, this one right under the TV. It's a photo of Richard Adams. Tony and Richard were married 37 years. Richard was the love of Tony's life.
I have it situated so when something comes on television and either upsets me or makes me happy, I stop and talk to him, you know.
How old is that photo?
That was taken probably the year he died.
2012?
Yeah. He was 65 at the time.
Tony and Richard met in 1972 at a gay bar on Sunset called The Closet.
Did you know from the beginning when you first met him that this was going to be the man that you're going to be with for your life?
No, I didn't have a clue. Not a clue. I met him by accident. I mistook him for someone else in a darkened bar. We stopped and talked, and I am really convinced that we were made for each other. And I can't think of another human being that I've ever met that I could have had the relationship with that I've had with him.
Tony's Australian. He's 75, an age where a lot of people are comfortably retired. But Tony's future is uncertain because he's undocumented.
Now I really am feeling the income problem because Richard's income was combined with mine. I can't collect my Social Security at this time, which I've paid into for decades. So it's difficult at the moment and it's very frustrating not knowing what the future holds and not being able to make decisions.
Tony's undocumented because for decades the federal government didn't recognize his marriage to Richard, an American citizen. They were one of the very first gay couples married in the United States. They tied the knot in 1975, the same year they moved into the Afton Arms. And Tony applied for a green card, but the federal government said no because their marriage was not valid.
When we realized that we could not stay together in the United States under the immigration laws, we said this is a terrible injustice.
After Tony's green card was denied, 500 people showed up for a rally supporting him and Richard in downtown L.A. This and a few other bits of old sound you'll hear in this story are from a PBS documentary about Tony and Richard. It's called Limited Partnership. Tony and Richard decided to sue the government. It was the first federal lawsuit seeking equal treatment for same-sex marriage.
We knew what we were doing. We were doing it to stay together, but we were totally aware of the fact that we were fighting an issue that needed to be fought and that the laws needed to be changed.
Today, we're asking Judge Hill to order the immigration...
This is their lawyer, David Brown, right after filing the lawsuit. He held a press conference in downtown L.A.
What will happen if Judge Hill turns down your request?
We will appeal to the Federal Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit.
Tony and Richard did lose. The case dragged on for 10 years. Eventually, it did end up at California's Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in front of a panel of three judges. This was Tony and Richard's last chance.
It was a bizarre hearing. The attorney for the Immigration Department kept getting everything confused. She got our nationalities confused. Judge Chambers fell asleep and started to slither under the bench. He was helped out by the bailiff or whatever they call it. They pulled him back up on his seat. But they did decide against us 2-1.
They lost for the last time. The judge who wrote that final decision against them, Anthony Kennedy. The same Anthony Kennedy who's now a Supreme Court justice. Tony and Richard made one last-ditch effort to stay in the country together by going to the press. They made their case on the talk show Donahue.
I think if two guys want to get married, that's their business, and why don't we let them get married?
And today...
This Saturday, Anthony Sullivan is scheduled to be deported to his native Australia.
But none of it made a difference. Tony was scheduled to be deported. So, just a few days after Donahue, they packed up their apartment in Hollywood and took off for Europe. They didn't have any real plan other than staying together.
You know, Richard had a great way of looking at things. When we arrived in London, and it was the coldest winter of the last century, turning around to me and saying, well, let's have the honeymoon now we never had. And we turned the lemons into lemonade.
For 11 months, Tony and Richard traveled around the continent. They went to Paris 5 times. They got down to their last 69 cents. Finally, they made their way to Mexico, and they snuck across the border back into the U.S.
When you really got a really good relationship going, there's nothing you can't deal with.
Were you scared when you eventually snuck back in through Mexico?
Yes, of course I was scared. God only knows what would have happened if they'd stopped me, but did it all the same, you know.
Tony and Richard returned to Hollywood, but...
When we came back from overseas, the building had gone downhill and had become a crack house.
So they moved out again. Until one day, by chance, Tony ran into the owner of the building.
I gave him a hard time about what he had done with the building. He said, if you think you can fix it up, I'll let you be manager.
And Tony took him up on it. This turned out to be really lucky. As an undocumented immigrant, Tony's job prospects were limited. Managing the building meant free rent, and he even negotiated an under-the-table salary. He also turned out to be a great property manager. I asked him what kind of work he would have done if he hadn't been undocumented.
Well, I had some writing published. I might have been a full-time writer, who knows. At one point, I really considered studying law. I just don't know, but I definitely would have done something different to what I've done.
As the years went by, Tony's undocumented status kind of faded into the background. Tony and Richard settled into ordinary married life, legal or not. They saw friends. They hosted dinner parties.
Oh, yeah. We had great dinner parties. We had wonderful friends, wonderful conversations, great happiness. We had some wonderful times in this apartment.
Then they got bad news. Richard was diagnosed with advanced lung cancer.
From the day he was diagnosed, the day he died was exactly a month. The day before he died, we went to see a Woody Allen movie and went out for dinner. No, that was such a blessing. He didn't go through all that horrible stuff.
Richard died December 17th, 2012. 2.5 years later, the Supreme Court legalized gay marriage nationwide.
He said, for it embodies the highest ideals of love, fidelity, devotion.
This is NPR's legal reporter, Nina Totenberg, reading from the decision in June. The justice who wrote that decision, Anthony Kennedy. Yes, the same former appeals court judge who'd rejected Tony and Richard's case all those years earlier.
Indeed, he observed, for much of our history, homosexual relationships were condemned as immoral, even criminalized.
I'm just thrilled that he is a human being who has the ability to grow. So actually, I have good feelings towards Judge Kennedy.
For Tony, the decision, after so many decades in the shadows, after Richard's death... felt anticlimactic.
It was a great moment of victory, but I just felt detached from it. But I am very proud of what we did. I mean, okay, we may not have had children, but what a child we had.
After the decision came down, Tony went to D.C., and he joined the celebrations and made speeches. But when he returned to Hollywood, the reality of life without Richard hit him hard. So did the fact of still being undocumented. It's weird to be alone after so many years of life revolving around just staying with his husband.
The depression I've experienced since he died is worse than anything I can ever remember.
Do you think that having some closure eventually on the legal status will help? Is that part of it, that you're in a limbo?
Oh, I'm sure that'll have some influence, but well, who knows how I'll react to that. Maybe I'll go to Palm Springs and get drunk for a weekend. Who knows? I have no idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a side of me, and this may be self-defense, there's a side of me that takes the attitude, oh, I don't care anymore. And I actually do care, but that is a protection. That if things go wrong, I can say, oh, well. Mm-hmm. I've spent most of my life concealing my feelings, which is my biggest mistake as a human being.
Now Tony has applied for citizenship as a widower. He expects an answer any day.
What a wonderful life I've had. I mean, really, a wonderful life to have been involved in an unbelievable love story.
Yeah.
I think every child, boy child as well as girl children, fantasize about being in love, and I got it.
Is he buried in L.A. or nearby?
No, his ashes are next to my bed. Our dream is to be put in the cemetery in Paris, the same one that has Oscar Wilde and Jim Morrison. So that's where we'd like to end up. May end up in the Hollywood forever, who knows. I want us to be put wherever we go together.
When the time comes, Tony knows what he wants the grave to say. Richard Adams, Tony Sullivan, their birthdays, the dates of their deaths, and under that, another date, 4/21/75, and one word, married. For Press Play, I'm Anna Scott.
And Julie Myers is here now with the listener feedback. Hello.
That's right. I have all of the feedback today. And our listeners, we're talking about PCBs today, especially our Malibu listeners. We talked about how there is PCB in the caulking of Malibu school windows, Malibu High, Malibu Middle School, etc. Bob Templeton thinks it's crazy that different EPA regions have different rules about cleaning up PCBs and what's acceptable in schools specifically. He says we should really have a national policy about something this important. Max Brava says, though, that wouldn't it be nice if all schools in Los Angeles had celebrity power working for them to clean them up, whether it's PCBs or general bad things that are happening in schools? And Mark W. Oda says, you know what, Malibu is an exclusive enclave, but this exclusivity of having PCBs, not really something that they want there in Malibu. Mm-hmm. So plenty of comments. Keep them coming. KCRW Press Play on Facebook and Twitter. Those are the places to get us. Not Snapchat yet, even though we talked about Snapchat
really?
On the show. Yeah.
Not Snapchatting?
Yeah. Maybe we should do
that.
Yeah.
We need to hire a middle schooler to manage that
yeah.
Snapchat.
Yeah,
account.
Interns apply.
Oh, child labor laws. Okay. Jolie Myers, thank you very much. And thank you so much for listening, no matter how old you are. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.